From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Calling All Pets. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller, here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. We're here every week to help you bring out the best in your pet's behavior. So if you have a question about your animal's antics, give us a call now. Here's the number, 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. And as always, we have another great topic to share. And what is it this time, Tricia?
We're going to talk about post-traumatic stress disorder and whether our pets can suffer from it too. You know, there's some evidence that suggests that's actually really possible. We're going to talk about it.
Very interesting. And we'll also be talking to primatologist Franz De Waal. He's written a book called Our Inner Ape that explains just how similar we are to other primates.
How about that? Oh, it's a great book. It's you could pick it up and you can't put it down. It's a read it till 3 a.m. book.
That's all coming up later in the show. But right now, we're ready to take some calls, and let's take our first call. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, you two. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet. Who are we speaking with?
My name is Chris. I'm from Brookfield, Wisconsin.
Pleasure to have you with us, Chris. What can we do for you?
My wife and I adopted our Australian Shepherd mix. About all we're sure of is that she's a brown dog. Got her about 4 years ago, and she was the baby up until about 3 months ago. Then we had our daughter, and now we prepared our dog Reese as well as we could. Did obedience for 4 years. She's a therapy dog and just a well-behaved dog. However, I didn't take into consideration that she always needs to walk to go to the bathroom. And now with Abby, our daughter, around, it's not so easy to get her out for a walk.
This is true of the breed of brown dogs, if I'm not mistaken.
This is true of many dogs, as it turns out. You know, and it's true at my place, too. It turns out that dogs need to get a certain amount of activity in their bodies and their intestines to get their intestines moving. There's some dogs that can just go out there and go. And there are other dogs who need, I have one of them, we just need to move around a little bit before things get moving in the right direction, so to speak. So there's not much you can do about that except that it's true. And given that she needs exercise not only to be able to move her bowels, but also for her own health, both mental and physical, what about hiring somebody to walk your dog for you?
And that's a possibility. I just haven't investigated that yet.
I would.
That's a great idea.
I would, and I think, you know, I've talked to a lot of clients about this, and it's not something that automatically comes to mind, you know, having a dog walker. You know, in the world of those of us who don't have gardeners and pool boys, you know, you don't tend to think of that. But it's, you know, I did it once when I got a new puppy, and I was working 12 hours a day, and I had a wonderful woman, a veterinarian, as a matter of fact, bless her heart, who was just out of vet school, and she came and spent an hour with my puppy. She walked it. She helped train it. She got it out to potty, and I paid her, and it was just heaven for both of us. So there's often people who are happy for some small compensation to go out and walk your dog. And so I would pursue it. It's a great solution for a while. And then pretty soon you're going to want to get yourself walking again, too, because that's good for you, right?
That's good for you.
There
is
that baby tunnel.
Well, and that's just it. Already I have the jogger stroller and things. So we're getting out.
Yeah.
It's just I didn't know if there was a way to reschedule Reese. But it sounds like that's the way she is.
And that's the way she is, yeah.
Okay. It's the brown dog breed.
Yeah, right, Larry. There's research on that, yeah.
Thanks a lot for calling. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call for you to join in. And let's see who's next. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, my name's Jennifer. I'm calling from Anchorage, Alaska.
Jennifer, pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you. I have a 2.5-year-old yellow lab female. Very, very sweet dog. Goes a little bit crazy when someone rings the doorbell or knocks on the door.
No, and, I've never heard of that problem.
No,
yeah.
No.
I've never heard of that problem. That's just bizarre. No, I'm sorry.
it's the barking. It starts off with the barking,
okay.
And then she's always been a very, very vocal dog. And then she wants to rub up against them, and then she wants to talk to them. And tries to jump on them. And it seems like no matter how many times we try to curb it, and no matter how many times the same person has come over to our house,
she's equally excited.
Yes.
Right.
And then sometimes if she has to go to the bathroom, that comes too.
Is she a lab who likes to put things in her mouth?
Yes.
And because therein lies a potential solution, the best solution I know, and I actually use this on my Border Collie Lassie, when I got her when she was a year old, she would leap onto the shoulders. I kid you not, as Dave Barry says, I am not making this up. She would leap onto the shoulders of people standing at my door when I first got her. She was a year old. So what I taught her to do is to go in the living room and get a toy. So you set it up so that she can win. You know, don't wait until there's a real visitor there and then try and teach her something new. Basically, what you do is you just go to the door with her. There's nobody there. There's no real visitor there. You go to the door with her. You knock on the door. Knock, knock, just a tiny bit. And then you say, oh, where's your toy? And you run in the living room and you get your toy and you wave it in front of her face and you give her a toy. Good girl, good girl. And you play with her a little bit. And basically, you gradually make it more and more like a real visitor coming. You have friends who are, you know, stooges, you know, who are setups to help you out, who understand that you're not going to open the door for a while because you're busy training your dog to run in the living room.
Give it a shot, Jennifer. And know that you are not the only person dealing with an excitable dog. We had Pet Tip. Donna from Green Bay, Wisconsin, wrote to tell us how she solved this problem with her dogs.
Yeah.
Donna had two German shepherds who loved to greet visitors by licking their ears.
That's a new one.
Yeah. So to prevent this from happening with her third dog, Tara, she got Tara a special greeting chair. And when Donna comes home, she tells Tara to go right to the chair. And then Tara stands with her front paws on the chair until Donna comes over to pet her.
I love it.
Yeah, and now when company comes over, they greet Tara at the greeting chair and enjoy a big wet kiss on the ear without being jumped on.
I love it. And you know, it's the same idea. Good for her. It's the same idea. Get the dog away from the door where all the sort of hysterical excitement is and give them something else to do. But there you go. Good for Donna.
I like those pet tips, and we've got places where people can go to send us more pet tips as well.
We do. We do. We love it if you let us know some ideas you've had to solve some problems, and all you need to do is go to pets@wpr.org.
And if you have a question for us, here's the number to call, 1-800-462-7413. And let's see who's next. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
This is Shelley in Logan, Utah.
Shelley, thanks for being with us today. What can we do for you?
We purchased a little Netherland dwarf rabbit about a year ago. She was about 5 or 6 weeks old.
Okay.
And my daughter is an absolute rabbit freak.
Aw.
Great.
And the rabbit's been handled a lot, and she's carried around all the time. And we have a little leash. She goes on walks.
Oh, cute.
She's a really sweet pet. And then because the weather in Logan gets really, really cold in the wintertime, and I used to live back east, and I remember when the weather got cold, they used to have announcements on the radio to bring all your pets in.
Okay.
That I thought, well, maybe we better make provisions for her in the house during the wintertime so she wouldn't get too cold.
Okay.
So we set up a second hutch down in the laundry room, and I was just prepared to, you know, endure the winter with the rabbit down there.
Yeah.
And she got real aggressive. I mean, like, immediately.
Really?
Oh, she growls, she snorts, she stomps, she attacks you, she bites really hard.
Oh, dear.
Is this in the basement?
And so I contacted the breeder. I said, what is up with this rabbit? And she just thought I was being silly for bringing her in, and that her rabbits do fine outside.
Mm-hmm.
So I put the rabbit back out in her regular hutch, thinking maybe it was a territorial issue, and she just, I don't know what was going on with her. But the aggression has continued.
Ooh.
Oh, boy.
So it got to the point where I told the kids they'd have to put leather gloves on. Now my daughter, who actually owns her, is the only one who can actually get her out of the hutch without getting attacked.
How old is she now?
She's a year.
And when did the aggression start?
November.
So it would have started when she was about 9 months, 8 months, 7 months. I'm trying to figure out if it had any kind of correlation with sexual maturity.
I was wondering the same thing.
Which is often a time when animals turn, as all mothers of adolescent girls know.
Right.
I was thinking about the furnace kicking on and noises in the basement that could have scared her.
And it's possible those things actually combine. Let's just take first things first. The issue about rabbits indoors and outdoors, they are indeed fine outdoors under a couple of conditions. One is they have they're sheltered from wind, they're sheltered from moisture, and they have some kind of insulation that they can sort of bury into. But, you know, if you think of wild rabbits, they're quite comfortable outside. But they have nice little underground dens where they live. And so you need to create some kind of straw insulation where they can make themselves a little nest. If they're used to being outside, might actually do better outside. Now, there are plenty of house rabbits who just do absolutely fine indoors, but I think it might be better to sort of be one or the other rather than back and forth season to season. So here are the potential things that I would look at if I were you. One is physical. There's a lot of aggression that's caused by some kind of physical discomfort. Maybe the animal's in pain. The first thing I would do is make sure that your veterinarian is absolutely sure that the rabbit is just great.
Yeah,
you know, there's virtually nothing you
point.
Can find wrong with that rabbit. The other possibility, I think, you know, Larry's comment about reacting to being put into this totally different place, since it started apparently right then, it well could be some kind of a combination of factors, age-related plus some kind of trauma-related or just discomfort or fear of sounds or something that the rabbit wasn't used to. So now what you need to do is you need to slowly sort of back your way back in. And what I would suggest doing is a kind of a counter-conditioning program. It's that Pavlovian conditioning I've talked about. Say you want to be able to put your hand in the cage.
Right.
So what you do is you're going to put your hand up, not in the cage, right next to the door of the cage. You're going to put your hand up and then throw a little tiny piece of carrot or something that the rabbit really loves. You're going to put your hand down. Then you're going to put your hand up. Then you're going to throw a little piece of food. You're going to do that like 10 times in a row. So what the rabbit learns is that as that hand rises, ooh, I got something really good.
Mm.
So just like a Pavlovian dog starts to drool, you know, when Pavlov came into the laboratory with the food bowls, the hand becomes a trigger stimulus that something good is going to happen. And what that does is that causes the rabbit's emotions to feel the same to the hand as she does to the food. So then the next step is the hand gets a little closer, a little closer, a little closer. Obviously, you should do this first. And the gloves are really smart. I think a lot of people don't realize that sweet little cute bunnies can bite very, very severely and can rip your belly out with their hind legs. So try that method and good luck.
Good luck. Thank you very, very much for calling. Still to come, a discussion with a leading primatologist about our inner ape. But next, we'll examine whether our pets can suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. And if you want to call us, we promise it won't be a traumatic experience.
Well, we're not. We don't promise, but probably not.
Probably not. Our number is 1-800-462-7413. I'm Larry Mueller with zoologist Patricia McConnell, and you're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Each week, Patricia and Larry give you great advice that helps you deal with your pet's behavior, but sometimes you want more. Do you want to go in depth into one of the pet topics you've heard on the show? Do you want more advice? More pet fun? Well, why not check out our website? It's callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I am Larry Mueller here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And before we go back to the phones, Tricia, you mentioned having evidence that suggests that animals can suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, we know it occurs in people.
Right.
And it almost sounded like it occurred in that rabbit we were just talking about.
Well, maybe, possibly.
But is it reasonable to talk about it in animals?
Well, you know, I think it is. And I should be really clear that this is not something that's discussed in the veterinary or the behaviorist literature. It just seems to me over the 17, 18 years that I've been working with animals that I see symptoms that are very similar. You know, post-traumatic stress disorder is something that happens in humans, we know, as a result of some kind of trauma.
Yeah.
Some kind of serious trauma, and the symptoms were, you know.
Yeah, what are those symptoms?
Yeah, we're very clear about those. People tend to be really hyperreactive, I had a friend who was in Vietnam, and there was a backfire just on the highway, and the man threw himself on the ground.
Yeah.
In absolute terror. He was absolutely terrified. So you get this hyperreactivity. Often with people, you get irritability, sometimes aggression, inability to sleep. And what I've seen in some of the animals I've worked with is after some kind of trauma, really serious dog fight, or they were terrified mm-hmm. by something, is I see this hyperreactivity, sometimes irritability, and sometimes aggression.
And are there other kinds of similarities that between people and animals?
Well, yeah, you know, I think there are. And again, I'm just, you know, I'm speculating
yeah.
here. But
go ahead and speculate.
Yeah, but,
why not?
But why not? Here's one of the things that links what I see in dogs, particularly, and I think it happens in horses and other animals, is once an individual has been traumatized, what happens is that the limbic system, which is the emotional centers of your brain,
yeah.
records all the information it can when the trauma occurs. All right?
Okay.
But it doesn't know what information is relevant. So, for example, there's a famous case in a human, a man who was almost killed by a truck. He was on the street. He was a pedestrian, and this huge truck came at him, almost hit him. He was lying on the pavement, and he can identify the species of dead moths that were on the grill of the truck.
Holy cow.
And so his brain recorded that as potentially dangerous because the brain doesn't know what part is dangerous or not. The dog example is I have, for example, a dog who's been attacked at a dog park will thereafter always be afraid of white dogs. Well, it wasn't the white that was the problem, you know?
Yeah.
But so what
happens...
So
they sort of generalize that out a bit?
Exactly. What happens is the brain and the individual sort of generalizes things. So that's partly why they're so hyper-reactive.
You know, I interviewed a doctor once. We were talking about post-traumatic stress disorder in people.
Uh-huh.
And he said it often didn't show up right away, that
exactly.
it sometimes manifested itself months later. Is that true with animals? Or?
Larry, that is exactly the symptom that I started relating to the dogs and cats and horses that I see, is because I'd see animals who had some kind of traumatic event, but you didn't see the symptoms of it until 3 weeks later, 4 weeks later, 5 weeks later. I even had a dog who was terrified by a big thunderstorm when we were working sheep. And it wasn't until about 2 weeks later he wouldn't go up in that pasture anymore and he wouldn't work sheep and I couldn't figure it out. I finally figured it out. So that's another reason I think there's a link.
What do we do about treating? Is there something that we can do to treat dogs or animals for post-traumatic?
Boy, that's a really good question. You know, a lot of the treatment with humans, you need to be able to talk. You know, you need language. People mm-hmm. will take them back to the trauma, relive it, sort of create a new ending. The best thing we can do with dogs, and sometimes it has been successful, is to do that counterconditioning I talk about a lot, where you figure out what the triggers are. You know, what is it that sets the dogs off? And then counter-condition them so the dog relearns an emotional connection between that particular event and his emotional expression, because that's what it all gets down to, is emotion.
Yeah. And, you know, just thinking about it, post-traumatic stress disorder probably, if it's going to occur, it's probably occurred in many animals in the South as a reaction to Hurricane
absolutely
Katrina.
No question. It certainly happened with people, and there's no reason it wouldn't happen with animals.
We got an email from Connie, who listens to us on WJSP in Warm Springs, Georgia,
uh-huh.
and she wrote about it. She writes, we recently adopted Molly, a two-year-old Labradoodle. We can talk about Labradoodle sometime,
right.
I'd like to do that.
Right.
She was brought up from Louisiana after Hurricane Katrina. She was treated for injuries and spayed before the Humane Society placed her for adoption.
Uh-huh.
And at first she was interested in the house and yard, but now she seems to be frightened of everything. I think she spent most of her life in a cage, and I think she suffers from separation anxiety as well as whatever trauma she experienced during the hurricane that separated her from her owners. And she wants some ideas about how to help this little dog. You know, she says she deserves a good life. And she says, my husband and I are very patient, but we don't want to reinforce behaviors that keep her from being less afraid as
yeah.
she matures. So far, they've let her hide in the closet when she feels like it. We sit with her on the futon and pet her constantly, but she cowers and begs for attention. So the question is, do we reinforce that begging when we pet her? My instinct is that she's due for a lot of catch-up petting and cuddling.
Mm.
But again, she wants to do what's right for her and not just what she thinks is right. So.
And good for her for asking. And what sweethearts to adopt this dog. I mean, what a wonderful thing for them to do. And,
yeah.
and those classic symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder is first they do okay, and then they start sort of falling apart.
Yeah.
So her question about She's due for catch-up petting is such a good one, because I don't find that actually to be helpful. And so often people will rescue dogs from whatever situation and feel like the dog had such a hard time. So what they need to do is they just need to always be there for them and always pet them and always love them. You know what? I don't think it helps. If anything...
goes the other way?
Sometimes I think it might. Because what those dogs need is they need to feel secure. They need to feel like they're with benevolent leaders. You know, they need to feel like they're with Gandhi, someone who knows what's up, who's going to take care of them, who's going to protect them, who is kind and patient and loving and fair. But just sitting and petting them whenever they ask for it. You know, if you be anthropomorphic, I think it's reasonable in this case to think about it. Are you going to feel secure if somebody gives you everything you want every time you want it? No, you're going to feel... short-term pleasure, but you're not going to feel secure about that person.
So maybe some obedience training?
So I think lots of really fun, teacher fun tricks. Don't push her. Be very, very patient. Teach her lots of fun tricks. Get her mind busy. Teach her, you know, teach her to sit pretty. Teach her to high five. Teach her to roll over. Teach her, you know, go get that ball, not your bone. Do some classic obedience stuff. Don't push her. Don't take her to a class all of a sudden where she'll be terrified by 10 other dogs or something. Just do it at home. Maybe even get a professional in to help you. Go slowly, but get her mind busy. That's what she needs as much
as
anything.
Get her mind off the person.
Yeah, yeah.
Great advice. And thanks a lot for emailing us. We really appreciate that email, and we appreciate all the emails we get. And we certainly appreciate the calls as well at 1-800-462-7413. And we have another caller online, so let's go to that caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, Larry and Patricia. It's Hank from Norman, Oklahoma.
Hi, Hank. What can we do for you?
Well, I really enjoy your show. I've got a corgi. And one of the things I've noticed is he really seems to want to herd things.
funny that should be.
Yeah, I can't imagine. He's also smarter than I am.
This is a problem with corgis.
Yeah.
People tell me they got a smart corgi, and I say, I'm so sorry.
Well, he nips at our heels and when we play. So I was wondering what sorts of play and training activities that I could give him that would link into these herding instincts. Short of buying a couple of sheep for the backyard.
It is the world's most expensive dog toy.
Yeah.
A farm and a herd of sheep. It's true.
Exactly.
It's a great question, and there are a couple things I would teach you. How old is your dog, Hank?
Two and a half.
He's a young guy, so he's sort of that young male adolescent.
Right.
So here are a couple things I would teach him, and they don't necessarily all relate to herding,
but
they relate to learning... frustration tolerance and learning how to monitor your own emotions, which I think all dogs need to learn, just like children do.
It's like adults do. Adults do.
Maybe I can use that.
So I would certainly, even though it seems sort of like, well, that's not very creative or exciting, I would teach him it's really fun to lie down and stay there, because when he's staying, you're going to bring the treats to him while he's still on the stay. So you'll hold your left hand out to sort of keep the stay, remind him, I didn't release you. And then with an underhanded motion, you move a treat to his mouth right where he is, so he doesn't have to get up. So he learns that if I stay here, the food comes to me, and I'm not going to get up. I'm just going to stay right here. And the herding dogs are really good at this because they're particularly sensitive to location. You know, location, location, location.
Sure,
right.
And so I would work on that. And, I would get him so that he does a downstay for a half an hour, maybe 4 or 5 nights a week in the evening.
Interesting.
Maybe
you
watch a half-hour show. It just helps them learn to inhibit themselves when they need to. With this nipping, one of the things, it's almost like fighting fire with fire. If you have enough control of a dog and you don't have an aggression problem with him, I think sometimes teaching a dog tug of war, and I used to be one of those people years ago who said, I don't know if you should teach your dog tug of war. Well, I don't think that anymore. That was then. This is now.
Okay.
And I think, if you have a dog who gets aggressive, then no, you shouldn't do it. But you can actually teach dogs how to monitor their own arousal level by you give them a tug toy. You teach take it. you know, wave it in front of their mouth, good dog, good dog, and you play tug of war with them. And then the trick is to teach them to drop it. So get a food treat in the other hand, and then you say drop or out or whatever you're going to say, and immediately move the food right to his nose, and most dogs are going to spit the toy out and eat the food. And eventually you can drop the food out. You just say out, good boy, and then you say take it. So his reinforcement for dropping it is he gets it again.
Okay.
And then you can play tug of war, and before he starts getting too excited, you can say drop. And he drops it, good boy, good boy. And so you can use that to get him excited and then calm him down and get him excited and then calm him down. And that helps these young dogs who are full of themselves and don't have a herd of cattle. It helps them learn to play politely and appropriately and to keep their mouth on a toy rather than your ankle.
Uh-huh.
That's a great advice.
Try that.
That is great advice.
Well, that's why I make the big bucks. No, I wish.
Wonderful advice.
I wish. That's why you called me. What did you call me? I loved it. America's favorite, public radio's favorite zoologist.
That's exactly right.
I'm just
right.
Gonna just.
You've lived up to your reputation right there.
My head won't go through the door,
you've
Mueller.
Lived up to your reputation right there. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Here's a number for you to call, by the way. It's 1-800-462-7413. Coming up next, primatologist Franz DeWall joins us to explain just how ape-like we really are. I'm Larry Mueller with zoologist Patricia McConnell, and you are listening to Calling All Pets.
Even man's best friend has a fault or two, so bring out the best in your pet with great advice from Trisha's dog training books. If you need help with a multi-dog household, or if you're feeling guilty about leaving your pet home alone, Trisha has a book that can help. Call the radio store at 800-747-7444. That's 800-747-7444, or visit our website at callingallpets.org.
You're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And we're glad to welcome primatologist Franz DeWall to the program. He's the author of several books examining human behavior through the eyes of primatology. And his most recent book is called Our Inner Ape, A Leading Primatologist Explains Why We Are, Who We Are. And Patricia, I was flabbergasted when I read this book. I learned so much about
us.
About,
right?
About, and also
right?
About bonobos and chimpanzees. Let's welcome Franz DeWall. Franz, thanks for being with us.
I'm glad to be there.
A pleasure. I was fascinated by your stories about chimpanzees and bonobos, and we certainly will talk about that. But why did you decide to call your book Our Inner Ape?
Well, it's a play on our inner child. So there is a child in all of us, we hope, and there's an animal in all of us, which is probably a primate. Some people may have another animal in themselves, but I think most people have a primate in them. Compared to my other books, this is more a book about human behavior. So in the other books, I usually describe just primate behavior and assume that people make the connection. But in this particular book, I wanted to make the connections much more explicit.
And, you know, one of the things I love about Our Inner Ape is that you, better than any book I've read so far, distinguish between our two closest ape relatives, chimpanzees and bonobos. Would you talk some more about the differences in behavior of those two species who are our closest relatives, right?
That is really fascinating. Please do.
Yeah, the bonobo is the least known, of course. Everyone knows a chimpanzee, and everyone thinks that chimpanzees are these cute, small animals that Hollywood presents us with. But chimps are actually big, strong animals when they're adult. And chimpanzees can be hyper-aggressive. And so in the field, for example, chimpanzees are very territorial, dominance-oriented. The males mainly are. They kill each other sometimes between groups, so they have a sort of warfare going. And that's the comparison that is usually drawn. People say, well, we are aggressive and nasty by nature. Look at our close relatives. They are the same way, and that's where it comes from. And then we have this equally close relative, the bonobo, exactly equally close.
A whole lot different from chimpanzees, that's for sure.
They're sort of primate hippies. They're friendly, sexy, peaceful. They share. They are tolerant. They're empathic. And they're female-dominated in addition. And so no one knows what to do with them. So in the usual evolutionary scenarios, since they are very much focused on male dominance and aggressiveness and all
right.
of that, they don't know what to do with bonobos. And so most anthropologists, they sort of neglect them. They say, well, yeah, we have that other one, but, you know, let's forget about it. Let's stick with the chimpanzee. But there's absolutely no reason for that because they're equally close to us.
Do you think part of it, and I'm really speculating here, although you mentioned this quite nicely in your book, that bonobos actually solve a lot of their conflicts with sex?
Mm-hmm.
And you've described them as the all-sex, all-the-time animal.
I certainly read like it.
I actually got in trouble once at a dog training seminar at a national conference in which I was talking about how the way we behave around dogs is based a lot on our primate mm-hmm. heritage, and I was showing videotapes of chimps and bonobos and humans doing sort of similar things. And mm-hmm. this is partly actually thanks to Franz. He mm-hmm. allowed me to use some of his videotapes. And so I was showing bonobos walking upright bipedally like humans do. And then I had a segment at the end of showing some scenes of sex
mm-hmm.
Of bonobos. And all of a sudden I realized I was showing basically pornography.
Yeah.
And do you think that sometimes people are a little uncomfortable with that, especially in this country?
Yeah, that's especially, of course, in the U.S. So in Europe, you can show bonobos having sex on primetime TV and no one blinks an eye. But here, people freak out over that. Although I must say that I give many lectures. The people who come to my lectures, at least, they are all prepared, I suppose. And they love it to see how bonobos handle this kind of thing. I always say, you know, people think, of course, that they have sex the whole day, all the time. But their sexual encounters are very casual, very relaxed, and very brief.
You mentioned that the reaction in Europe or elsewhere would be different from showing bonobos having sex than in the United States. And I think in your book you give us some reasons why people in other countries would react differently based in part on the density of population.
Well, I'm not sure that that's the main reason. I think the main reason is that after the 1950s, Europe sort of loosened up sexually, and so, for example, mm-hmm. being topless on the beach is okay in Europe everywhere, and the U.S. didn't for some reason. I don't know why that is. One of the reasons is, of course, that in a couple of centuries ago, we sent the most intolerant people to the U.S. and they're still here, you know.
I love it.
So, yeah, the people that we couldn't handle in Europe anymore.
A true European perspective.
they took the boat to here.
Franz, could I ask you to go back to something you had mentioned before, because I think it'd be of great interest to so many of our listeners, and that relates to the female hierarchy, the kind of female dominance you see in bonobos, which is so different than the highly hierarchical male dominant society in chimpanzees. Would you talk more about that?
Yeah, so I think the two issues that anthropologists have with bonobos is one is that they're not aggressive enough to their taste. And the second one is they really cannot handle the fact that females dominate the males. And that's really something that, of course, mostly male scientists have a problem with. Once you know bonobos, as I do, it is perfectly natural the way it operates. The males are not necessarily unhappy. They're not necessarily suppressed violently, even though the females dominate them assertively. But the males have a pretty good life with all the sex that's going on and so on. And the females have a very strong coalition, so it's a collective dominance of the females. It's not that an individual female bonobo can dominate a male, because the male is bigger and stronger and has canine teeth, and so the male is, and the female doesn't have those teeth. And so the male individually, and many zoos know that, if you have one male and one female bonobo together in an enclosure,
mm-hmm.
the male will be dominant. You put two females in there, immediately the females go on having sex with each other, and then they have a coalition, and before you know it, they overthrow the male and they dominate the male.
Well, I as somebody who doesn't know a thing about this topic and reading your book, I was fascinated, frankly, just by the society that chimpanzees have and the society that bonobos have, and how similar it can be to our own society.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so for example, the chimpanzee male is in many ways very similar to the human male. Let me give an example. The chimpanzee male is in a constant dilemma. He's competing with other males over females and sex and all of that, and so and over status. So there's a very intense competition among the males in which they do all their politicking and coalitions. But at the same time, all these males in the group need to stay united. They need to stay together because the neighboring males are aggressive. And so they either can expand their territory by attacking them, or they have to at least defend their territory against aggressive males. And so it's a very similar situation to, let's say, the human male in a corporation, where they're all jockeying for position, who gets the best office, who gets the parking spot, and all of that, who gets the best clients. So there's all this competition among them, but they need to stay united. There need to be a sort of corporate spirit of solidarity, otherwise the whole thing is going to fall apart. And so that dilemma, to me, is so interesting, and the chimpanzee male is very good at that. They're very good at having their competitions going, but then also reconciling afterwards and sharing food afterwards so that everything is sort of smoothed over again. And I think that's a very typical behavior in the human male as well.
In The Inner Ape, you talk about how still this discomfort that we see in the general public. You talk about people laughing, for example, at apes doing things, whereas they don't laugh at other animals.
Yeah, that's sort of amusing. We did actually research at the zoo where we would stand, students would stand between the public and time how long they would watch and what they would watch and what they would say and all of that. And it is remarkable that adults, and that's both true in Europe and in the U.S., adults laugh a lot when they see apes. And so everything that apes do is amusing and funny, and they will imitate them and they will scratch themselves and holler and all of that. And I think that's in order to create a distance between themselves, because they see immediately, of course, the resemblance. The resemblance makes them uncomfortable, and the reaction is to make a joke out of it. If you look at young children, children of, let's say, between 5 and 10, they don't have that. They take everything seriously. They look at these apes, they immediately see, of course, the connection between themselves and these animals. And if the apes have a fight, they are worried about them. If the apes are playing, they have fun with them. And they sort of interpret much more closely what these apes are doing rather than creating this distance by making stupid jokes about them.
I wonder, as we near the end here, I wanted to ask you about war. Human beings have always been at war. What can we learn from bonobos to maybe help us overcome those tendencies? Or maybe we can't overcome those tendencies.
Yeah, I think we are highly territorial. We're highly in-group, out-group animals, very much like chimpanzees in that regard. That doesn't mean that you cannot overcome it, because there is a way of doing that. As a European, I can tell you the secret to that. because Europeans have been waging war for 5 centuries or more, killing each other on a massive scale. And after World War II, there were certain politicians who said, well, what do we need to do? What we need to do is create valuable economic relationships between these countries. If we do that, they will stop fighting. So the reasoning is very similar to what we do in primatology, because I've done a lot of research on conflict resolution, and our main hypothesis is that if the value of the relationship goes up, the intensity of conflicts will the conflicts will not disappear, but the intensity will decrease, and the tendency to make peace afterwards will also
interesting.
Increase.
Interesting.
And so what the European community did originally, now it has become a different enterprise, but originally the main goal was to tie Germany and France together in one economic pact so that they would stop sending armies to each other. And I think that's the same way the world, if you get more integration, economic integration in the world, international conflicts have to go down. And actually, that's already happening. I don't know if you've seen the recent graphs that have coming out. Conflicts between nations are decreasing in the world. The main problems we have nowadays in the world are internal conflicts between ethnic groups or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I bet it is largely because of the economic integration where it becomes costly to attack somebody who's also a trading partner.
And what a wonderful example of the many ways we can can look at the behavior of other animals and learn from them. You know, we may be pretty smart, but it doesn't mean we don't have a lot to learn from other animals.
And you outline this so well in your book. And here's the cool thing. Patricia is an expert, and I don't know anything, and we both love the book.
Oh, it's a great book. It's just a wonderful book.
And I thank you so much for being with us. Really,
you're welcome.
I really appreciate it. Franz de Waal is the author of Our Inner Ape, A Leading Primatologist Explains Why We Are Who We Are, and he spoke to us from his home in Stone Mountain, Georgia. Stay with us. We're taking more of your calls next here on Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Do you have a question for Patricia? I know, just call the 1-800 number, right? But you're shy, and the idea of talking on the radio gives you hives. So how do you get your question on Calling All Pets? We have a solution. It's called email. Send your pet behavior questions to pets@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you.
You're listening to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Wisconsin Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. Glad to have you listening in. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can by calling 1-800-462-7413. Give us a call. And we have callers online. So welcome to Calling All Pets. Hi there.
Hi, this is Andrea from Boise, Idaho.
Andrea, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. Well, I have two cats. A male and a female, and the male pup, he'll start cleaning the female squeaker, her face.
Squeaker.
Yeah, Puck and Squeaker. And then he'll start chewing off her whiskers.
Oh, my goodness. She needs her whiskers.
She needs them.
She needs her whiskers.
Oh, my goodness gracious. How often does he do this? All the time or on rare occasions? Or
Enough so that if they start going back at all, he'll do it again.
Oh, no. It's no help that I find this amusing, is it?
No.
It's really not to Squeaker. Let me ask you this. Does it seem to affect Squeaker in any way?
She's still, I'm not really sure. She's kind of more timid than Puck is. I mean, she'll definitely run off.
And, you know, it's hard to say. She may be more timid just because genetically, innately, she's a little bit more
timid,
shy and a little more timid. But, you know, cats really do use their whiskers to gain information about the world around them. They're pretty blind for things right in front of their face.
Mm-hmm.
You ever given a cat a treat, you notice that they're not very good at it. We don't think they can even find the surface of the water very well. So they need their whiskers. You know, the only thing I can think of to do, there are two things I can think of to do. One is put something that doesn't taste good to cats on her little whisker stubs.
Okay.
Maybe a citrus oil. Cats, theoretically, the ones who read the books anyway, don't like orange, lemon. They don't like citrus kind of flavors. Mm-hmm. So if you just got a real citrus oil and just put a tiny little bit on her little whisker stubs. Don't put too much on her face, because then she's going to, when she's grooming herself, she get it on her paw, and then
she's not,
we don't want her
happy
to stop grooming
yeah,
herself.
Yeah, because that was my concern, that it was going to get on her face.
Right.
Like, oh.
Right. That would not be good. The other possibility that would eliminate that confounding factor would be, every time you're around anyway, is every time he starts to do it, don't punish him in any way, but do something that appears to him as if it just occurred out of nowhere. You know, the sky is falling. So he starts to do it, and you drop the book you're reading, and there's a noise, and he startles and turns around, and then you redirect him to do something else.
Okay.
And you don't want to scare her, you know, so you're going to have to experiment and find just the right level to get his attention. You just want a startle response, a mild startle response, but you don't want to scare them.
Okay.
So he turns and looks at you, and then you're going to give him something else to do. And that's the trick. If you startle him and then just stare at him, by the third time he'll be like, oh, okay, I've learned that noise that she makes doesn't mean anything, and it won't work anymore. So as soon as he looks at you, you need to give him a reason to have looked at you.
Okay.
So try and get him, see if you can get him munching on something more appropriate, you know, some kind of a toy, hopefully not something he'll eat, but see if you can get him in using his mouth on something else besides Squeaker's whiskers.
Yeah. Give that a shot.
Okay, I'll try that.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate you.
What if your boyfriend chewed your hair off?
Oh, sucking on your hair.
Yuck.
No.
Yuck.
1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Jean from Buffalo, New York.
Hi, Jean. Thanks for calling.
I have a dog who I think is smarter than me.
Oh, uh-oh. Well, join a very big club.
But he's doing something that's driving me crazy.
What's he doing?
I'm a professional puppeteer, and he's chewing on my puppets.
Oh, dear. Oh. This is
he's
a crisis.
He's gotten 18 in the last month, never chewed on anything until now.
Oh, no.
He's 7 years old, and he's a Rottweiler German Shepherd mix, and I've had him for 3 years.
And he just started this.
Yes. Recently, the alpha dog died. She's a little beagle. And he's becoming more and more demanding every day since her death. And I think that this is a symptom, but I don't know how to stop it.
I think you're absolutely right. I think your speculation that it has to do with his friend and potentially leader disappearing is very, very relevant. I actually, my Border Collie Lassie, what became literally a wreck the day after her father, Luke, died.
Oh.
Just a wreck. And it took about 6-8 months to get her back comfortable again. But she is now, so that's the good news.
Well, this is about 6 months since the other dog died.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I
assume you have the puppets in a trunk now or something.
No, there's 2,500 of them. And they're on shelves, and there's no shelf he can't reach.
Oh.
Well, the first thing I was going to say, I'm a bit taken aback because the first thing I was going to say was the first thing you need to do is just to handle this logistically. I don't know what your house is like, and it's 2,500 puppets.
That's
a lot. But somehow you need to figure out a way to keep him away from them.
I've tried, and I can't do it. You see, I have another problem. My husband's allergic to dogs and cats. And so he has to live in the basement, and so do the puppets.
Oh.
And it's not terribly large, and if I cut off the part with the puppets, he doesn't have any room.
So he's alone in the basement now?
Yes.
How is he with other dogs?
He doesn't like other dogs. That's another problem.
Mm.
He loved the beagle,
mm-hmm.
and he seems to be attracted to beagles, but he doesn't like anybody else.
Well, here's a possibility.
Okay.
I would contact a well-trained behaviorist or a trainer who really, really knows about using conditioning and positive reinforcement. And I would have them come and help me, and I would pick out a beagle, maybe an older beagle, a sweet little female. Is Yerati a male?
Yes. Neutered.
Okay. But still, I would pick the opposite sex.
Oh, definitely.
Because you have a higher probability they'll get along. I would find a sweet little beagle, and then with a professional there, I would introduce them. You have to do this very carefully and very safely. Maybe, some way in which their first encounter is the Rottie can't possibly hurt the beagle until the beagle becomes familiar. Maybe you have a gate in between them that no bites could occur, inside of or something like that. And then gradually, hopefully, these two would become friends again. Because one guess is that it's not just about the sort of leader dog going away. It's that he's lonely and he's frustrated in the basement. So increasing exercise outside, taking him out more often, lots of exercise for him, maybe some interactive toys in the basement. But I would hire somebody and try and help them matchmake and do the right first dates so you could get these two together. Because given all your logistics that you're describing to me, that might be your best shot.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, well, good for you. Good. Follow your instincts then.
Give it a shot. Thank you very much for calling. 1-800-462-7413, our number. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Nicholas from Lexington, Kentucky.
Nicholas, thanks for calling.
Well, I've got a 7-year-old Labrador Chow mix named Cleo. And what's going on with Cleo is I got her when I was 19, and I was still living at home with my parents.
Okay.
And then I, shortly thereafter, within a year after getting this sweet little puppy, I went off to try to become a man. And I didn't take the dog with me, and my parents are gracious enough to look after my dog.
Mm-hmm.
And each year, I would say, hey, I'm coming back. I'm going to get a yard. I'm going to get a house.
And then
get my dog. She's become so attached to my mom, we're afraid that after 7 years,
You might want to leave her with mom and
dad.
Right. What can I do to transition her to the new house that would make it easier on her?
Well, before I answer that question, let me ask another one here. Larry was going there, and I'm going to do the same thing. Does your mom want the dog out, or does she want the dog to stay?
My mom understands that I really want possession of the dog, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, the reason I ask that because one possibility that comes to mind, and I'm sure a lot of listeners are thinking the same thing, is what if you left Cleo with your parents and you got another dog?
Got another one.
I know everybody thinks their child is the best.
You love your Cleo.
Yeah, there won't be another dog like this.
You love your Cleo. I hear you.
Do.
I hear you loud and strong. Okay, here's what I would start doing is, do you live close to where Cleo lives?
Yes.
Good.
It's about two blocks.
Oh, that's great.
Oh,
so
good.
I would start taking her on lots more walks. I would maybe take her some new fun places. If she does well going to new places, some dogs don't, some dogs do. Maybe get involved if she does well in some kind of activity with her, like agility or tracking, something she thinks is just really the bee's knees. And why is that a good thing, by the way, bee's knees? No idea where that came from. Anyway, something that she really loves. And she's like, oh, we get to do this together, him and me. This is really fun. I would take her over to your house a lot and hang out there. And then I would have a sleepover one night.
Mm-hmm.
And given that she knows you so well, she loves you, right?
Right.
Well,
yeah.
I think she'll do fine. Usually dogs do better than we do, actually.
I worry more about
change.
Mom.
I'm worried more about mom, too. I think Cleo will be fine. Just make it a gradual transition.
And you might get mom another dog.
And you might get mom another dog.
I don't think Dad would like that very much.
Got it. We haven't talked about Dad, have we? Dad comes in the picture. Well, good luck. I think you'll be just fine.
Thanks.
Excellent. That makes me feel a lot better.
Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Tricia, thank you as well.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's my pleasure as always.
Patricia McCottle is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. She's here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Don't forget, if you have a pet tip to share, send it to us at pets@wpr.org. Calling All Pets is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster. Joe Hartke is our engineer. Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
For a copy of today's show, call the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0414P and bring out the best in your pet with great advice from Tricia's dog training books. Whether you need help with training a new puppy or if you're feeling guilty about leaving your pet home alone, Tricia has a book that can help. Call the radio store at 800-747-7444 or visit our website at callingallpets.org.